You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the Disease du Jour podcast. I'm your host, Carly Sisson, and in this episode, I spoke to Dr. Lauren Bookbinder about neonatal maladjustment syndrome and full sepsis. This episode of Disease du Jour is brought to you by Equithrive. Dr. Bookbinder is an assistant professor of large animal medicine at Michigan State University's College of Veterinary Medicine. She earned her degree from Cornell University and continued her specialty training through an equine internship at BW Furlong and Associates and a large animal internal medicine residency at Michigan State University. Following this, Dr. Bookbinder was a faculty member at Cummings School of Veterinary Medicine at Tufts University and cared for patients both in the field and at the university referral hospital. Dr. Bookbinder has an enthusiasm for teaching and preparing students to be confident veterinarians. She is also passionate about large animal neurology, neonatology, antimicrobial stewardship, and preventative health. Thank you, Dr. Bookbinder, for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
So we're going to cover both neonatal maladjustment syndrome and full sepsis in this episode. The two conditions obviously have a relationship to each other, but just starting out with neonatal maladjustment syndrome, what do we currently know about what causes this condition?
Yeah, that's a great question because this is a pretty common problem of our neonatal foals. And I'm really glad that you used the term neonatal maladjustment syndrome. There are some other kind of older terms for this condition, but NMS really is the right one because it captures like all three potential etiologies of this disease. So like when I talk about this disease with clients and students, I separate it into three main kind of risk factors or causes. One is going to be the most common, and this is the kind of classically described one in the literature. These are like otherwise healthy fetuses that would be healthy foals, but they face a dystocia and hypoxemia. And as a result, they develop what we call reperfusion injury affecting their brain because of hypoxemia during parturition. And then they can develop really clinical signs referable to like oxygen starvation of any really metabolic organ. So, of course, the brain is going to be a big one, but also like the kidneys and the GI tract. So that's like number one, what all the vet students remember and what kind of the older terms refer to. What's important about that etiology is that clinical signs can take about 72 hours to develop because it's not necessarily just the original hypoxemic event that causes problems. It's actually like oxidative damage once those tissues are exposed to normal levels of oxygen again. So it's kind of a two-hit problem. You can have the initial oxygen starvation and then secondary oxidative damage up to a few days later. The second category I think of is like there's been a problem with the oven. So there's something wrong with the uteroplacental unit that might be like overt placentitis or an overt placental insufficiency or something that is only microscopically detected or sometimes not even microscopically detected. But these are foals that really just didn't cook appropriately for some sort of reason. Sometimes we know why, sometimes we don't. These foals can be born with NMS and be like overtly premature, or they can be dismature, meaning that they have markers of underdevelopment, but they are at a normal gestational age, or they can even be postmature. So mares that go much longer than they should, we always get a little bit worried about like, what about that unit wasn't developing the foal on time? So those are going to be foals at risk of NMS too. And then probably the one that gets the most like attention in the media now or in the last 10 years is a subset of foals with neonatal maladjustment syndrome that have some sort of like complicated issue with neurosteroid production right at the end of parturition. Foals are really unique because compared to other species, their adrenal gland matures really, really late in gestation, like just in the last 24 hours before they're supposed to be born. And that maturation process occurs when the adrenal gland acquires enzymes that can convert the stimulation of ACTH to actually produce cortisol. When they're in utero, that synthetic process, the steroid synthesis process stops at progestogens or pregnanes to keep the foal really quiet. And right before they're born, that process has to continue all the way to produce cortisol, which helps them adapt to stress and extrauterine life. And that timing is really, really tight in foals compared to other species, which is one reason why they don't tolerate prematurity very well compared to like people, for example. So some foals are probably born before that adrenal switch has totally completed. So they might be like stimulated to produce cortisol, but really all their adrenals are capable of producing are these like progestation neurohormones that actually keep them really quiet, which is adaptive when they're sitting in the uterus, but obviously not so good when they're meant to be like bouncing up and running around and chasing the mare all around.
Right. Do these different causes create different clinical signs or affect how you might manage these cases?
Probably not, other than like the risk of, so the short answer to that is generally no. Like I don't look at one NMS foal and say, oh, you're, you know, one of these three etiologies. I think we probably just don't have like the precision to really do that. Maybe anecdotally you can get some suggestion, but for me, what is potentially important here is if there's anything that I think is likely to repeat itself. So why did the foal have a dystocia? Is there something maybe with the gestational or fetal size or mare conformation that might make this likely to happen again? I do think there are some mares that just don't make particularly robust placentas, and they may kind of year after year have dummy foals and some placental insufficiency. So I think thinking about these etiologies is important when you're considering or questioning if this has been a pattern or if this is likely to just be kind of an unlucky one-off.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. This podcast is brought to you by Equithrive. Breeding places a unique and time-sensitive demand on the mare's body. Following breeding, a healthy uterine immune response and timely return to balance are essential for creating an optimal environment for conception and early pregnancy. University studies show that Equithrive mare pellets support post-breeding uterine immune balance and inflammatory resolution during the most critical stages of the breeding cycle. Do you have a problem mare? Learn more about the science behind Equithrive mare pellets by clicking the link in the description or visiting equithrive.com. So when you're called to evaluate a compromised neonate, what are some of the clinical signs that raise suspicion for NMS? And how do you differentiate this from some other conditions that might present similarly?
Yeah, that's a really good question too. And of course, like we all kind of latch on to the neurologic consequences of NMS. But first and foremost, important to remember that NMS, neonatal maladjustment syndrome, means that multiple organ systems can be maladjusted to extrauterine life. So the systems most at risk of that are the ones that really didn't need to do anything in utero and all of a sudden have a big job to do. So that, of course, is going to be the brain. Those are the classic, most common signs of NMS, which I'll describe. But we also worry about the gastrointestinal tract. So can they ingest and digest milk appropriately without colic, without bloat, without diarrhea? And then the urogenital system or the urinary system specifically, are they capable of producing urine and regulating their own fluid balance normally? And then kind of plus or minus the respiratory system, that becomes more salient when the foal is truly premature and not necessarily just an NMS foal. So like I said, the neurologic system is the one we classically think of and most sensitive to these three etiologies. One of the biggest things I'll hear like clients or referring veterinarians describe is a foal that's like sleepy or lazy. And to me, that foal is like neonatal maladjusted until proven otherwise, for sure. Or sick for another reason, but it's usually it's like NMS plus some, it's either just neonatal maladjustment syndrome or maladjustment syndrome plus something else that's affecting the foal. It's usually not like just something else when they're describing these sleepy or lazy foals. Particularly a really common history is like, oh, they seemed great for the first 6, 12, even 24 hours, and then they've just gotten sleepier and sleepier. And that often occurs because of that kind of secondary damage if there's been hypoxemia. some of the more like specific neurologic signs that vets will pick up on or like really astute owners will describe is like a loss of affinity for the mare. So these foals have previously been called like wandering foals, where they just won't track alongside her, which they should in the first couple of hours. They will have an inappropriate or absent suckle. So another really common clinical sign would be a foal that just won't suckle at all. They just kind of chomp the air or do nothing. Or they'll suckle like at the mare's elbow, they'll suckle the wall, suckle her stifles, like they'll look for any sort of like hood to put their head under or like corner to find, because they sort of know like where an udder should be geometrically, but they won't repeatedly find her udder. They can also be really inappropriately responsive to stimulation. So usually baseline, they're really dull. And then when you touch them or stimulate them, even lightly, they're really hyperreactive, almost trending towards seizure activity and sometimes turning into overt seizure activity. And more so than just like a normal foal that's a little flighty.
Right.
They can also do some odd vocalizations like barking. These foals also kind of in the olden days were called barker foals too because of that. And then less common neurologic problems, but possible ones would be dysphagia. So it can sometimes affect their ability to swallow normally. So you'll see milk coming out the nose. Big differential for that's going to be a cleft palate, which your vet can, or a vet can usually distinguish between. And then like total recumbency, minimal response to stimuli. A lot of things could make that foal sick, including neonatal maladjustment syndrome. And then kind of the most serious neurologic complication from NMS is going to be seizure activity, which can look like a classic seizure we would all like expect from TV. But in foals, they can be pretty subtle. And sometimes what you'll see is they're just like treading their feet when they're laying laterally. And that is often like focal seizure activity that we recognize in these foals. And then, of course, like urinary, gastrointestinal, plus or minus respiratory system signs if they're more severely affected and it's not just their brain.
Okay. So I'm sure that everyone listening is familiar with the Madigan foal squeeze technique managing these foals. So I'd love to hear your perspective on, you know, how effective is this procedure? When is it most effective? And are there any neonatal maladjusted foals for which it's not effective?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a really cool, like the thought behind it and definitely the like cross species inferences because of what people do with premature babies and like skin to skin contact and hugs and all that. It's really like, it's really smart to try to make those connections into veterinary medicine too. But I do think it's really important to be attentive to like these three etiologies and all the complications that neonatal maladjusted foals can have. The Madigan squeeze is really meant to like re-stimulate the foal to think, anthropomorphic term, but reset them physiologically to like going back through the birth canal. It is most appropriate for these foals, this probably small subset that truly have like a neurosteroid problem. So I think probably the like most effective way to answer that question is to think about like, what are the best possible foals to squeeze? And those are going to be foals that really have no other risk factors for NMS. They were not a dystocia. The mare doesn't have a history of this. Their clinical examination is otherwise normal. And they're like relatively mildly affected. And sometimes with this procedure, like the proof of the pudding is in the eating. You'll do this, squeeze the foal, they'll be quiet for 20 minutes and somewhat somnolent. And then they bounce up and they're pretty normal. That actually has not been my experience with it, but I also work in a referral hospital, right. So I see the sicker foals anyway. So I think, you know, in the absence of clear, like, concern for sepsis, things like seizures, other body systems affected besides the neurologic system, it's certainly worth a try, but I have pretty strict standards for, like, if that's going to be the only thing I do for this foal, I want to make sure that they respond really quickly and they're meeting all of the other benchmarks. I think this technique has to be taken with a little bit of a grain of salt if you have a client that leans on this instead of additional kind of supportive care and management. I think that's maybe the risk of it because it's really cool. It's really sexy sounding and it's obviously very cost effective.
Yeah.
So you just have to be sure that we're not doing it as a, it's adjunctive to and not a replacement to other supportive cares that the foal might need. Overt contraindications for me are going to be any dystocia with a risk of rib fractures because you don't want to be squeezing those and cause like a hemothorax at the kind of extreme end. And then foals that are really like down and out and sick. I don't actually want to make those foals necessarily quieter. And I certainly don't want to manipulate their neurosteroid production kind of inappropriately.
Right. For foals in which it's indicated, is there a time frame that it has to be done to be effective?
I don't believe so. Again, I don't see a lot of these really mildly affected foals because when they come to me, they're like those things haven't worked.
Yeah.
So I would say like as if it's an otherwise pretty normal foal, like as soon as you start to see those clinical signs, because I don't know that that's necessarily like a limitation of how long it will work, but like what other complications is this foal accumulating if you wait? So in general, like whatever you're going to do for these foals, you want to do as quickly as possible.
Right. So what are some of the other therapies that you would use to help these foals, especially when they've come to you in a hospital setting?
Yeah, that's a great question. And there are a ton. Like I said, I think the foal squeeze is like an adjunctive therapy to kind of all these additional things foals might need. And again, remembering like they need neurologic support as well as other body system supports based on what's affected. So at a minimum, the management has to include things like nutritional and glucose support, fluid support, assuring that they get a normal colostral transfer, so they have a normal IgG, normal adequate passive transfer, and then really, really close attention to the risk of sepsis and preventing sepsis. Of course, like ensuring adequate passive transfer is one component of that, but then I am pretty liberal with antimicrobials in these foals just because the outcome of sepsis can be so detrimental for the foals and it can really affect their prognosis quite dramatically if they become septic. I would say like in a referral setting, so the big limitation with these foals is going to be, does their GI tract work and are they neurologically appropriate enough to, with assistance, nurse on their own? If the GI tract isn't working, then we have to default to some IV fluids and nutritional support. If the GI tract is probably working, but they're not acquiring nutrients, they're not figuring out nursing well enough to be even assisted, then we have to tube feed them. And those two things just by definition put them in a like 24-hour care facility bucket. So these guys typically are most successful when they do get referred really early. That referral question is probably best answered by like considering the subset that maybe don't need referral. And for me, those are foals that with whatever degree of assistance the farm can manage, can figure out nursing on their own every, you know, at least 2 hours. Some farms are going to be able to maybe have someone there round the clock that leads the foal to the udder and ensures that they nurse. But in the absence of that, then you're just kind of automatically looking at referral.
Right.
And that's even for like the healthiest subset because they really cannot go more than 2 hours without a milk meal.
Yeah, tough if you don't have round-the-clock staff at your farm to manage
Definitely.
That, for sure. I know that prognosis is going to be really dependent on the severity of the condition, but do you have any figures on what the prognosis looks like for some of these cases, especially if they don't develop sepsis?
Yeah, foals that sort of just have neonatal maladjustment syndrome, about 80% of them go on to live normal, happy, healthy lives. And this is mostly evaluated in racehorses where you can follow lineages, but they are just as successful as their siblings and their peers if they just have neonatal maladjustment syndrome and they receive, obviously, appropriate supportive care.
So why is it that foals with NMS are at an increased risk of sepsis?
Yeah, that's a really good question too. And there's kind of one big answer and then a couple maybe like sub answers to that. So first and foremost, it's going to be that not nursing adequately. So not getting enough IgG in the appropriate time frame, which puts them at risk of either complete or partial failure of passive transfer. And then of course, sepsis. There are some other kind of sub factors for sepsis associated with neonatal maladjustment syndrome too. These foals tend to spend a lot of time recumbent, which means they're breathing in and their belly buttons are exposed to like a relatively higher environmental bacterial load than a normal happy, healthy foal. And then similarly, like if their GI tract is a little bit sluggish and they're not moving milk that they are getting through well and develop things like diarrhea and inflammation in their gut, then they can have bacterial translocation and become septic from that too. So the big one is the passive transfer and acquisition of colostrum, but then just the way they navigate their environment tends to give them a bigger bacterial load too.
Okay. What are some other common causes of neonatal sepsis in foals that don't have NMS?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I like to think of sepsis as, or the risk factors for sepsis, which is really like the environmental challenge from bacteria and the acquisition of colostrum. Those two things are kind of in a race with one another. So there's like a race to get into this foal that's born between the bacteria in the environment and the colostrum from the mare. And really, whoever wins that race determines if the foal becomes septic. So of course, you have like the colostrum side of it. They need good quality really pretty quickly in order to prevent sepsis, but you also have to pay attention to the environmental side of that too, because they will be exposed to bacteria. The dirtier the environment is, the more that you're asking that colostrum to overcome to prevent sepsis. So a kind of illustrative example of this is like when you compare the quantity of IgG that's necessary to like, quote, prevent sepsis in a foal compared to a commercially raised dairy calf, calves need like 2 to 4 times as much. And that isn't because their bodies are weaker or the colostrum's not as good. So you need more of it. It is really a reflection of that environmental challenge. So having really good husbandry is an important part of that equation too. So foals that are kind of born surprise out in the field or in a dirty, like non-foaling stall, things like that, are going to be at risk of sepsis, even if they get, quote, adequate colostrum.
Okay. Do you think that every foal should have its IgG tested? And, you know, if a client maybe declines having this done, you know, what is the risk that that foal might become septic?
Yeah, you know, it's just like, yes, an emphatic yes, every foal should have their IgG tested. Of course, you know, clients will make decisions that they think are best for them for a variety of reasons. But I do think, you know, especially as you're developing your practice and particularly as you're like engaging with breeding work, I think it's very reasonable as a veterinarian to kind of set standard of care expectations for your breeding clients and people that you're seeing routinely, that includes that initial kind of first 18 to 24 hour foal assessment, which should always include IgG. The importance of that is that you're giving yourself some objective criteria to manage and predict risk of sepsis so that you can intervene quickly. And that's really important in foals because if they become septic, their prognosis for survival and certainly athletic function drops precipitously and pretty quickly. So as much information as we can gather to make sure things are going well, the better these foals are. And it's just, you know, it's such a fragile transition in life that setting the standard that you go and evaluate the mare, evaluate all body systems in the foal, and part of that is doing an IgG is just, you know, these are big investments for people, so it's a bit silly to not check all those boxes.
Yeah, that's great advice. What is the best way to identify septic foals in your experience? I know that this is an area that you've done some research into.
Yeah, that's a great question. And this is going to be a bit of a surprising answer given my research is in like lab diagnosis of sepsis, but this really is a clinical diagnosis. There will never be a single lab test that is efficient or effective enough to pick up on sepsis well enough that we can rely on that and not use our kind of clinical diagnostic skills. When we look at the literature, like defining foal sepsis scores and some of the like blood culture methods for detecting sepsis, nothing is as good as kind of the internal algorithm of an experienced clinician. who's just seen a lot of foals and seen what septic foals look like. That being said, for like new graduates or for people that aren't doing a lot of foal work but kind of get pulled into it every once in a while during busy seasons, I would say relying on like a sepsis score is really useful. It's kind of a blunt instrument, but it really helps people that haven't, professionals that maybe don't have quite the clinical intuition, develop some benchmarks to calling a foal septic or not, and then modifying their treatment plan based on it. The original sepsis score is from 1988. It's a Brewer and Caterva article that has been modified. So it's been modernized a little bit, I think most recently by Wong out of Iowa. But any of those sepsis scores kind of cover all of the clinical and blood work parameters that we look at to call a foal septic.
Okay. So I imagine that waiting to actually confirm sepsis officially, you know, you need to start intervention before that happens. Yeah. So what should like sort of your immediate intervention look like? What are some of your treatment options? You know, what does that whole process entail?
Yeah, that's another really good question too. So yes, like once you're, and I tell students this all the time, that when they're evaluating a new foal, you want to assume that it's dumb and septic until proven otherwise. So just default, these problems are so common and they're so interrelated that you will really, you're much less likely to go wrong if you default to like assuming the foal is going to have these issues and then convincing yourself that it doesn't, if that makes sense. So if you're even suspicious of sepsis, there's no 100% accurate definitive diagnosis for it. If you think that they're septic, then you do want to start treatment right away. And that mainstay of treatment is going to be antibiotics, and typically IV antibiotics, which is another reason why most of these suspected septic foals end up just getting referred right away. And they do best if they're referred right away, because we can start IV antibiotics. What I think is really important for veterinarians to be aware of is, once you think the foal is septic, plasma becomes kind of an adjunctive therapy. Plasma is better to prevent sepsis, plasma and colostrum, than it is to treat it. You can make an argument that it's helpful in treatment too, but it would never replace IV antimicrobials for a foal that you think is currently septic or at very, very high risk of becoming septic. In my mind, I just consider those foals septic already if I think the risk is that high. So you can do plasma, but you just want to be really upfront with your client that, you know, that the horse is out of the barn, so to speak, at that point, if they've already become septic. So it'll help, but what the foal really needs are antibiotics.
Right. What is the prognosis for septic foals, especially if they are referred and treated appropriately with antibiotics?
Yeah. So the prognosis, so neonatal maladjusted foal that's referred, treated appropriately, 80%, even some studies up to 90% chance, happy, healthy foal, a couple $1,000s, and they perform as expected. When they become septic, that drops really quickly to like in the 50 to 60% range. And that is kind of a twofold dip in prognosis. One, these foals typically feel really crappy because they're septic, they're bacteremic, they're systemically quite ill. So they have to meet benchmarks of like controlling that systemic bacterial load. And we can usually get a good idea of that in the first 24 to 72 hours of treatment. But then foals are unique when they're septic because we also have to worry about kind of localizing signs that can develop anywhere from, you know, in those first couple of days to even a couple weeks after they're overtly systemically septic. And the big concern that we have with foals is bacteria localizing to the joints, right, which is going to, of course, potentially affect their athletic function, pending how quickly we can sterilize it, and even like their quality of life, just as like happy, healthy pasture animals, if like multiple bones and multiple joints become affected.
Right. So you may end up with a live foal, but maybe one that wouldn't have a great quality of life moving forward.
Yeah, definitely. And those cases are really heartbreaking because we often pick up on the joints once we've fixed everything else, and they just take some time for that bacterial load to grow to the point where the foal is clinical for a joint infection. And often they actually look quite good and healthy aside from that. And it's just then becomes a question of kind of how many joints and how easily it is or isn't to sterilize. And it's the joint as well as like the physis and the bone itself. And those different, slightly different locations of infection can affect prognosis too.
Are there any mare or foaling or early management factors that can reduce the risk of developing NMS and sepsis? Obviously, you know, intervening with colostrum or plasma if the foal doesn't have high enough IgG, but, you know, anything else that you think is useful to remind our listeners about?
I think particularly for people that are advising clients that maybe aren't potentially new to breeding, just emphasizing how important the husbandry aspect is. So helping those clients be really knowledgeable about what normal partition is, normal benchmarks, so they know when to call you, they have a plan of when to call you, when to monitor for partition, to prevent dystocia, which is a huge risk factor for NMS. Taking really good care of the mares and the ovens, so to speak, good preventative health care and general health care for her. And then maybe, especially new breeders love to acquire like seasoned brood mares that have been open for a couple seasons, or maybe had like a couple, they're in their 20s and have maybe had a couple foals that haven't done quite as well. Being a little bit wary of that, especially with a novice breeder. As a veterinarian, I think you can sometimes sniff those situations out a little bit sooner if your clients consult you beforehand. And then again, that early intervention is so key. So setting that precedent for the first day neonatal exam, and of course, close attention to the mare too, and then make that foal prove to you that it's not dumb and septic. Assume it won't be normal, and then be pleasantly surprised when it is.
Yeah, that's good advice. Is there anything else you'd like to add on this topic or about any of your research before we wrap up today?
No, I think foals are one of our like most favorite, as large animal internists. We're a little bit polarized in like there are internists that love foals and internists that don't, but those of us that love foals, like there's nothing more fun. Their physiology is cool. Of course, like helping them is awesome. Their dynamics with the mare and watching that bond develop is great, and their potential as pets or athletic animals. So I guess I would just say like, lean on your referral institutions, really like hold yourself and your clients to really like high standards for these patients too, because they are like significant investments usually. What is really important as a veterinary professional to remember about these foals is that they are a really good opportunity to use your diagnostic clinical skills. So really good history, good understanding of like the mare's health history, parturition, and your clinical evaluation of these foals. Obviously, when you like first start, you're not going to have this yet, but the literature does show time and time again that nothing replaces that internal experienced clinician algorithm for correctly identifying these conditions and foals. So if you're a new graduate, don't be discouraged, like leverage things like a sepsis scoring system, but know that nothing really replaces putting your hands on a lot of foals, seeing a lot of foals, and doing really, really good physical exams and histories.
Awesome. Well, I think that's perfect advice.
Yeah.
So thank you so much again, Dr. Bookbinder, for joining us. Really appreciate having you on.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Thank you for inviting me on.
Thank you again to Dr. Bookbinder for joining us. And a big thank you to Equithyre for supporting this episode. And as always, thank you to everyone who tunes in and listens to Disease du Jour. If you have any questions or suggestions for the podcast, please send me an email at csisson@equinenetwork.com.